Good afternoon. Let's go ahead and get started. This is a public rulemaking hearing held in accordance with the State Administrative Procedure Act, Section 244103, Colorado Revised Statutes. The date is May 1st, 2007. The time is 1:33 p.m. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and I'm convening the hearing in accordance with the rulemaking notice published in the Colorado Register on April 10, 2007. The purpose of this hearing is to receive comments from the public on proposed amendments to the Secretary of State's election rules. As stated in the notice of rulemaking, the purpose of this rulemaking is to consider amendments and revisions to the rules concerning mail ballot elections, recounts, recall elections, county security procedures, and such other rule amendments as may be necessary to answer questions arising under Title I of the statutes, which is the State Election Code. The Secretary of State's office has prepared a draft of the proposed amendments to the rules that was distributed to the public and published on the office's website. A revised version was distributed and published on April 26th, and that's the version that we'll be working off of. A copy of that revised version is on the table by the back door. The office has also prepared a regulatory analysis of the proposed rule amendments that was also published on the website and made available to the public on April 26th, and that's also on the table at the back of the room. Let me do some other introductions. To my immediate left is Holly Louder, who's the Director of Elections for the Secretary of State. To my far left is Dan Kopelman, Elections Technology Manager for the Secretary of State. And then to my right is Hillary Rudy, Legal Specialist for the Elections Division. This is a formal rulemaking hearing. It's audio recorded. All comments become a part of the official legal record. And the hearing is also being broadcast over the internet. For anyone who wishes to testify, there are sign-up sheets on the table by the back door that look like this. You do need to sign up in order to testify. And I should mention that also for the record, our office has received some written comments that also will be a part of the official record and will be taken into consideration as well. Before I turn to public testimony, I would like to just summarize the rule changes just for the record. Rule 2.9 deals with homeless voters and clarifies what may constitute a residence for homeless voters. The proposed rule would allow a homeless voter to use a non-traditional residence to register to vote as long as their precinct can be established by a physical presence. This rule was actually suggested to us by the Attorney General's office in connection with current litigation that the Attorney General's office is involved in. The amendments to Rule 10.4 deal with deadlines for candidates for statewide office. Specifically, the amendments would conform the deadlines for providing audio recordings to the other deadlines that deal with candidates filing their acceptance and affidavits of intent. And the purpose is to ensure that the counties have enough time, the counties and their vendors have enough time to program their audio ballots as required by Section 1-5-704. The amendments to Rule 11 make numbering corrections and also clarify which devices are selected for post-election audit in accordance with 1-7-514. Rule 12 is being revised to implement requirements under HAVA concerning accessible walk-in polling places. The purpose is to ensure that all Colorado voters are afforded the same opportunity to vote in private and in an independent manner in accordance with HAVA, the Help America Vote Act. The amendments to Rule 14 establish uniform recount and precount testing procedures for direct record electronic voting systems as required by Section 1-10.5-102. Rule 32 is being revised to clarify the method of calculating the number of signatures for a school board director recall petition. And the purpose is to ensure that the number of signatures required for a petition to recall a school board director does not exceed the number of votes cast to elect the director. And then finally, Rule 43 has amendments to implement uniform county security procedures. The Secretary of State is required to establish such standards under Section 1-5-616. The rules are based in part on national reports that were reviewed by the office staff to ensure that identified vulnerabilities were addressed. And the purpose is to mitigate those known security risks and establish uniform statewide standards for ensuring the integrity of elections. So that's just kind of an overview of the purpose of the rule changes. With that, I'd like to turn to public testimony, and I will turn to the sign-up sheets. I think the first person signed up to testify is Al Kollwitz. Mr. Kollwitz, if you'd like to step to the podium, identify yourself and who you represent, if anyone, and give us your testimony.
Yes, my name is Al Kollwitz. I am the Executive Director of CAMBR, Citizens for Accurate Mail Ballot Election Results. And I want to thank you for complying with the rulemaking statutes. My colleagues are, many of them are across the street trying to improve rules, Senate Bill 083, and I'm sorry they can't be here. They may peel in at the last minute, but they're here in spirit. I have a document which I will turn in to you. I'd like to preface the turn-in, though, with coloration here. There is a set of short introductory comments which I want you to understand are directed at the institution and not at any individual. The introductory comments are harsh because it's trying to communicate the frustration of the public who have been trying to become involved in election quality in Colorado. The detailed comments extend over six pages in total and are illustrative rather than comprehensive. So by that, you should infer that if a discussion were to ensue, it would extend across many additional topics. I'll give you the copy for your...
And thank you.
And there might be interesting. I will read the first introductory comment and then I'll just summarize further what is already summarized. This is regarding the proposed election rules 2, 10, 11, 12, 14, 32, 43, dated April 26th. The Department of State has chosen to operate in a secretive, arbitrary, and anti-scientific manner. This has cost the Department highly valuable voluntary contributions of many experts who have shown their interest in election quality. It has cost the voters of Colorado a trustworthy election system. Examples of this assertion include many problems and suggested documents have been submitted to the Department of State and have gone unanswered. Some of these documents have received non-responsive responses. In other words, there's a piece of paper coming back, but it doesn't solve the problem. Secondly, the Department of State consistently refuses to engage in open conversation and debate regarding election system issues. This comment is relating to the public. Parenthetically, this refusal is one-sided and unfair. It is used to exclude voting system quality advocates but does not exclude county clerks, election officials, and hand-picked people. It is hoped that the Department of State will discontinue its practice of exclusion and replace it with a policy that will lead to trustworthy elections. This requires that election processes be held to uniform standards and metrics, and that every element of the election system be secure, accurate, verifiable, anonymous, accessible, transparent, and accountable. That is the end of the introductory statement. There are a lot of angry people, and I'm trying to summarize it in that short, brief statement. And for the benefit of the audience who isn't aware, members of the public who are very interested in elections have tried repeatedly to enter into two-way communications on these complex systems matters and have been rebuffed by the Secretary of State, using the pretext that it is against the law to have two-way communications with anybody on election rules. But we know that they are having these discussions with election officials, and we know they are having these discussions with their hand-picked people. But we feel affronted. Now, let's go on to the details, which is what you're really after. The following are our critiques of the proposed rules and regulatory analysis. Is there some... Yeah. Hey, I'm suffering cotton mouth. Firstly, regarding nomenclature, this is a simple change. The proposed rules and the regulatory analysis and occasionally incorrectly refer to a section of a rule as, quote, rule X.X, end quote. Changes are made to rules, not to sections of rules. And when a rule is open for revision, the entire rule is to be considered. That's a big deal that these are called rule X.X instead of rule X. Now, with respect to the proposed rules themselves, each of the proposed rules lacks necessary mechanisms to create a uniform election process that is secure, accurate, verifiable, anonymous, accessible, transparent, and accountable. A non-uniform process is not acceptable because it results in the disenfranchise of voters and non-deterministic elections. For those of you who might be new to the word non-deterministic, it means that if you ran the same election the second time, you might get a different result. In addition, there are no verifiable standards, metrics, or data capture requirements needed to achieve this uniform election process. In other words, what this is saying is if you don't have standards, then you can't yet have rules. And the standards have to include measurements. They have to include really specific metrics. They have to include what happens if it fails, for example. The following points are intended to illustrate such deficiencies and are not intended to be comprehensive. The proposed rules must be withdrawn until the necessary mechanisms are included. I go through then each of the rules to and I give examples. The first example here is Rule 2. This is regarding homeless voters, and it allows a homeless voter to register to vote using as his residence address a park, for example. Now, this virtual residence address, I would imagine, appears in no county assessor's resident property address table and occurs in no county clerk's residence table. Therefore, how will the virtual residence address offered by a homeless person be verified at the time that a person comes in to register to vote. Typical residence address verifications just don't contain the data. Will the homeless voter's eligibility to claim the residence address be verified? That means, will we check that this person is entitled to claim this address? Or might the person actually claim your address or my address and be authorized to do this? In a mail ballot election, how will it be verified that ballots are hand-delivered by the election officials to residence addresses that have more than five eligible voters? For example, let's say a whole troop of people move into your community and they all register at a park. Now, they have to have mailing addresses. Those are going to be, I don't know what, a common box, who knows what. How is this all going to work to prevent election fraud? Because as we all know, in the normal, if I may use that word, not pejoratively, in the normal population, people in this country move about once every 5 years. That means about 20% of the people move every 5 years. That means that the voter registration file is out of date, 20% of it, every year. That means that if you have homeless people, I would assume that their mobility is higher. I don't know that's true, but assume that it is. That means that these addresses are going to be used for mailing mail ballots, so who knows who is going to wind up receiving them. So the question is, how will it be verified that these ballots are properly managed? How will the jurisdictions for each residence be verified? In other words, we hear a lot about districting. We hear, you know, congressional districts, that's a big deal. Then there are special districts, you know, water districts and so on and so forth. Is it going to be the case that suddenly parks are going to wind up in the special district election and anybody who wants to from anywhere in town that wants that bill to pass, that wants that issue to pass, can sign up to vote in that park? Is that what that means? To get more votes out? How will each of the voting eligibility requirements of all electors be verified? For example, how will citizenship be verified? We know now that Social Security numbers no longer represent numbers that are used by citizens. The Social Security Administration is issuing Social Security numbers to non-resident aliens on purpose. Is our Driver's License Bureau trapping those somehow and telling our Secretary of State and the clerks that these people are really not eligible? How is that supposed to work? A, if this document doesn't say it's supposed to work, and B, it doesn't tell us how it's supposed to work. Once verified, when and how will each eligibility requirement be re-verified? Because once a person is registered, their eligibility requirements change potentially over time. They change because they move. They change because they die. They change because who knows what? They go to prison for, you know, child abuse or something. How will poll watchers and others gain access to copies of the up-to-date voter eligibility computer data files in a portable format? That isn't addressed in the document or in the rule. And we think that's an issue that has become a problem in some areas. Now, I have for each of the rules illustrative comments like this. I can go through them. I can highlight them. I can do what pleases you. I can turn in the paper and save your time. Give me some direction.
I would like to ask a few questions that it might help answer that. And I think when you talked about, before you got into the particular rule 2.9, I think you had just said that as a general remark about the proposed rules that there are no verifiable standards, metrics, or data capture requirements needed to achieve this uniform election process. So I think what I heard you saying was that's the kind of thing you're talking about, is how do you verify these things? In other words, it's not necessarily that there's metrics in the sense that you can measure how many homeless people there are or whatever, but I think you're looking at, in this particular case, you're looking primarily at the ability to verify certain things. Is that correct?
That is correct with regard to those points, yes, exactly. On the broader scale, we believe that it's imperative that you be able to verify every step of the election. And that doesn't happen by going in after the fact and trying to figure out what happened. That happens by preparing to verify in advance. For example, if I ask the question of you, give me a list of the people who accessed this privileged file and when they did so, and if it required supervisor override, who authorized them to do this? After the fact, you couldn't answer that question. Before the fact, you can establish a systems rule that says there must be a log to capture this information, and that information must be available on demand.
So, I mean, in looking at verification, I mean, a couple of the examples that you gave, that for homeless voters, you wanted to know how would citizenship be verified.
Well, that's a broader than homeless voter point. It's everybody.
But we don't verify citizenship for other voters. So are you saying we should for homeless
absolutely.
Voters?
Absolutely. It's the law that a person must be a citizen in order to vote. And if you're not doing it, then that job is not being done, if the department is not doing it.
So the criticism is not really to the rule. It's really to the fact that the law right now doesn't require verification of citizenship.
The rule... I guess I don't understand. The law says that a person must be a citizen.
But there's no verification of that. Nobody checks citizenship papers when they're
written. I don't know. I mean, an appropriate response is we don't do that and we don't believe it should be done, or we don't do that and it really ought to be done and we're going to run across the street and try to get it fixed. But right now what you're saying is it's very easy to get identification. It's very easy to get registered at the Driver's License Bureau, and there is no checking of citizenship eligibility because the statutes do not require it.
Okay. So again, it's not really a criticism of this particular rule. It's a criticism generally of voter registration.
A hole in the system, yes.
And I take it the same thing would be at the top of your second page. You said, how will homeless voters' eligibility to claim the residence address be verified? And same thing, we don't verify other voters that they actually live at the residence address that they list. But again, I'm assuming that's just a criticism that kind of verification doesn't go on for other voters either.
I guess, as I think about the way you're thinking about this, there are certain things that the department chooses to do that are not in the law that seem to make sense, and they do it. And there are certain things that are in the law that the department chooses not to do, and they don't do it. Let's talk about the first. I'll give you an illustration. The counties have for quite some time been offering what we refer to as unsolicited absentee ballot applications. We have complained to the Secretary of State about this practice. There is no provision in the law to do this, and the Secretary of State just doesn't care or says, you know, whatever. So what I would expect is that perhaps the Secretary of State might look and say, wow, people are supposed to meet this criteria, and if we're going to have a really trustworthy system, we ought to check. And if there's a problem with it, the legislature ought to jump on you and say, hey, we don't want to do that. We want to make the law anybody can vote. That's fine if that's what they want to do. But I don't think that's what they want to do, and I well know that's not what the people want to do. But that's what the effect of saying and doing nothing is. And that's why we are saying.
Are you suggesting, though, that the Secretary of State should require that not just homeless voters' citizenship should be checked, but
absolutely.
every voter's,
absolutely.
That the Secretary of State could adopt a rule to to require verifying citizenship?
To be purist, because I'm a purist, right? If the Secretary of State decides that the eligibility requirements of the voter are not to be checked, or these are not to be checked, it would be satisfactory for us to have a rule that says these eligibility requirements are not to be checked. That's fine. I mean, we can go fight across the street about that, but you can't fight fog, and that's where we are right now. So we're not trying to create the policy, we're just trying to create the architecture that allows for the development of meaningful policy.
Well, maybe one last question on this particular rule dealing with homeless voters is, what specifically would you suggest as far as how voter registration should be handled for homeless voters?
I don't know, and I don't have a problem with homeless voters. I'm strictly looking at the vehicle, the mechanism, and to the extent possible, all of the means of authorization and so on should be probably indistinguishable, if possible, from other voters.
Okay. Well, then, and you asked about, you know, then the remaining comments on the other rules, and it's really up to you. I mean, we do encourage people to provide written testimony, which you have and which is very much appreciated, and we will look at it. But at the same time, if it's helpful to you to, at the very least, highlight some things.
Well, if I may.
Sure.
If you have the time.
Mm-hmm.
What I'll do is I'll kind of read and then pick. It may take a little silent time here. Rule 10 concerning ballots and election supplies. The rule doesn't tell us how it will be verified that paper ballots, electronic and paper, such as VPAT logs of votes, comply with Article 7, Section 8 of the Colorado Constitution regarding anonymous ballots. The reason that points there is that there is a severe problem in some counties, including my county, Boulder County, with the use of non-anonymous ballots. So we're asking that the rule clarify that these documents and files must comply with the Constitution. Or, if they like, they can write a rule that just says, you don't have to comply with the Constitution. We're bigger than that.
Mr. Kolwitz, I guess I would like to limit you a bit. I know that the comment there is relates to your opening comment that you feel like any whole numbered rule that's being amended by these proposed rules is open for discussion. And so I think you're asking or making a comment not about the proposed change to Rule 10, but you're asking about things you would like to see in Rule 10 that aren't subject to today's hearing.
Right, and that's based on two things, Mr. Hobbs. The first is that if a rule is crafted in such a fashion that the perturbation of one element disrupts the rest, you certainly can't ignore the rest. And I don't think you would argue that you do that. I mean, but I think you can envision a case where you might change a sentence here that really has far-ranging implications throughout the entire rule. So there is a need to extend beyond the change. But secondly, as I recall, and you're the expert, but as I recall, this was discussed and perhaps even codified in fact, during the rulemaking process, that the opening of a rule subjects it to a wider inspection. And I could be wrong. I'm working from memory right now.
And I actually do disagree with you on that. I mean, I understand that there may be matters tangentially related to what's proposed to change that might actually be relevant to be brought up. I'm not trying to be that narrow about it, but here in Rule 10, I think the only change relates to the deadline for candidates to provide audio recordings of their the pronunciation of their name.
The change, no problem. I don't disagree. What I'm talking about is a matter of fact, and we can look at that, do some research and find out. But logically, it seems that the inspection on a broader level makes sense. And as a matter of fact, I'm not sure. I'm not sure whether or not history says that that is, in fact, intended.
Well, it may just be helpful then if, I mean, we'll look at everything that you provided, but if you, I think it would be helpful if you focused on the comments that you have that relate to the proposed changes.
Well, surely we're not, I will comply with what you say, and I disagree with what you say, because as a result of making the required, the suggested changes, you have a system that is not acceptable, and here's an opportunity to fix it. Okay, so let me see. I need some kind of a reference.
Okay.
Okay, Rule 10, change, excluding a discussion on the problems with the rule, which you don't want to hear about. Rule 10, change, deals with candidates, recordings, and I don't think we have any written comments about that aspect.
Okay.
On Rule 10, concerning voting systems, the change relates to the audit. And our first comment under Rule 11, rules concerning voting systems, both Eagle County and Boulder County canvas boards each filed with the Secretary of State a post-election audit exceptions report. These reports were to be published with the post-election audit report, but were not. Both individually, these are totally separate things going on. Eagle County and Boulder County indicated major problems with the post-election audit process. So our questions are, first, how will it be ensured that future Canvas Board exception letters are published with the audit report? There's no comment in the rule change to address that, and I believe we are talking about the audit. Secondly, what rule changes are proposed to resolve the problems identified in the Eagle and Boulder County post-election audit exception reports? And third, have Boulder and Eagle County campus boards agreed to the proposed changes, that the proposed changes will resolve these problems? I, as a member of the Boulder County campus board, can assert that we have not been informed of any changes to address our problems. Next, what scientific evidence is there that shows that the post-election audit and LAT accomplished their objectives? And what is the quantification of these objectives? And what happens if the test fails? There's nothing in the report. There is no science. We've been told that there is no science, no scientific research, no reports as an official document from the Department of State. We would like to understand what accuracy is determined by the post-election audit in LAT and what is the confidence level and the accuracy level claimed. Those are rational, reasonable questions to ask of an audit. I'll skip down here. This is an important one that ought to be covered by this rule. During the post-election audit in LAT, each person conducting a count of ballots must be unaware of any previous count of that same data. In other words, to use the vernacular, the count must be a blind count. Otherwise, the counting teams converge. They back into the number. They back into the answer. And we've seen that in Canvas boards over and over. We've seen that in LAT over and over. This compromises the audit. So the rule should state very clearly blind counts are required. What random number generator program is used to select random numbers? A standard web accessible program and a company procedural guide should be used by all of the counties. What peer-reviewed study, skip that. Let me look over here for a minute. We're talking about the VPAT here, and maybe here it's appropriate to ask, how will it be verified that blind voters can verify what is printed on the VPAT? You think about that. There is no provision that a blind voter can verify what is printed on the VPAT. And we have three vendors supplying equipment where this cannot be done. These are all certified and approved by the Secretary of State. How will it be verified? Well, that's dealing with security. How will it be, this is relating to the post-election audit, how will it be assured that the post-election audit data are published in a portable format that can be directly imported into spreadsheets and database programs? The Secretary of State's office has the habit of printing what amounts to Excel files or database files in a format that cannot be retrieved by anybody in the outside world. They can be seen, and they can be printed, but they can't be downloaded and used. And that's a violation of our interests in open access to records. The records are up there. I don't know if you understand the problem because so
you're saying that the documents that are posted at a PDF document, you prefer to have in an Excel format. Is that correct?
There are ways to post them in PDFs that could be downloaded as Excel or Access.
Okay.
But yes, we need them in an Access or Excel format or some industry standard format that's importable.
Okay.
That file and portability problem extends further into Canvas boards who are unable to get access to the records of the election. The election clerks are either unable because the data do not exist or unwilling because of some reasons of their own to provide election data to the Canvas boards. I'll give you an example. Boulder County uses a HART optical scanning central scanning system. Central scanning system scans ballot images into a computer file. After the fact, the ballot images are processed by inspection using a computer program provided by HART, and it produces what is called the cast vote record, which is the decision of how the software interpreted the votes on the paper ballot. Cast vote records are accumulated and results are produced as a report. The Canvas board is interested in a copy of the cast vote records. Specifications of the HART system say that they produce cast vote records, so they exist, or the specifications are wrong and they are defrauding the people that bought the system. HART people say there are no cast vote records that anybody can look at. Well, how can you canvass an election if you can't see the records? This rule ought to ensure that all necessary data to produce an accurate audit of the election by the Canvas Board is available to the Canvas Board.
If looks to me like the others on Rule 11 do go beyond the scope
yes,
of the changes.
Yes, I'm skipping past those.
Okay.
In Rule 12, there's the introduction of walk-in voting, and we have several points about walk-in voting. The first of which is, I'm not reading from a point right now, but you'll see it. When a voter chooses to vote in a mail ballot election, they are forfeiting their right to an anonymous ballot. One way of solving this problem is to allow voters to vote at a walk-in voting location using a paper ballot. Now, the walk-in voting location in the precinct voting location in Boulder County and in Eagle County, well, I won't speak for Eagle County, in Boulder County, allows people to come in and choose. I want to vote paper, I want to vote electronic. Every precinct. Early voting, same thing, you can choose. We're now bringing electronic voting to mail ballot elections. What we really mean to bring in is anonymous voting at the same time. And this would take advantage of all that Boulder has learned about conducting elections where both DRE and paper ballots are available in each voting location.
I had a quick question. Could you explain exactly how the anonymous vote is not being
allowed? How it's forfeited today?
How it's forfeited, yes. Exactly
In a mail ballot election, you are required to submit your ballot enclosed in an envelope. And on the outside of the envelope is your name and address and your signature and perhaps some other information about you. That's on the envelope. So anybody that looks in this envelope knows how you voted. And people look inside these envelopes. And these envelopes sometimes don't wind up where they're supposed to wind up. All right. So a way of avoiding this is you use a regular paper ballot and no envelope in a walk-in voting location, where you put the envelope yourself, put the ballot yourself into the cast ballot box.
So the secrecy sleeve and the observers from both parties and all of that are not, is that not part of the consideration when the mail
The secrecy sleeve is a means of shielding the contents of the ballot while it's being transported. But there's nothing on the ballot that identifies the voter. In the case of a mail ballot election, there is something on the ballot. It happens to be on the outside of the ballot that identifies the ballot as the ballot of the voter. This is against the Constitution. And there is provision in the law that says people that want to vote absentee give up their right to an anonymous ballot. And we want to allow people who choose not to give up their right to an anonymous ballot the ability to walk in, vote, and put their ballot not in an envelope, very definitely not in an envelope, but pure ballot in a secrecy sleeve, perhaps, into the ballot box.
Go ahead.
We're talking about the mail ballot plan. In 2001, six citizens in Boulder County conducted an extensive review of Boulder County's November 2001 mail ballot election plan. This was a one-time deal orchestrated by the then executive director of the elections division. And basically, there's a very substantial report. Now, we are interested to know which of these problems have been repaired. We're talking here about, you know, election plans. Which of the problems have been repaired and in the plan, right? And which of the problems are, you know, outstanding? These the fact that the public is disallowed from participating in the development of these election plans is insanity. The public knows a lot. And for election officials to set themselves up as arrogant know-it-alls is a bad move, because that creates distrust. And these rules should require public participation in the development of the election plan before it gets published, before it gets approved, before it gets submitted for approval, while there's still time to influence it. There's an issue on walk-in voters that you may or may not have thought about or may have discussed in detail. What happens to the mailed ballot of a walk-in voter? It's our recommendation that the mailed ballot be truncated, in other words, canceled. Now, believe it or not, we fully understand the significance of what that entails. But when a person appears in person to vote and says to you, I want to walk in vote, and you permit them to walk in vote, except that, by golly, they've already voted their absentee ballot, and they say, no, they didn't. You say, it says so here, yes, you did. And they say, no, I didn't. Now you got a spitting contest. And the correct resolution to that spitting contest is that a person who is present should be able to vote their own ballot now. And that requires us to be able to set up rules that cancel the mail-in ballot. Now, to prove to you that we understand the significance for the benefit of the clerks, this means that you can't start opening mail-in ballots until election day is over, because somebody may have walk-in voted, requiring a cancellation of a ballot. And we accept that. We believe that's a good move. You understand? Okay.
Anything else on Rule 12?
12, specifications. There's a description of procedures used in signature verification. We have a point. What scientific evidence is there that untrained temporary workers can detect signature fraud?
And I don't think we have anything about signature verification, do we?
Page 5 of 33. Okay. I mean, that's new item Q.
I'm sorry, where
you're,
are you?
You're 533. You're page 5 of, not my document, your document.
Okay, and I'm sorry, what line number?
Q.
I'm lost.
New procedure used for signature verification.
Okay. I mean, there's no change. That's just a renumbering. There's a relettering of that rule. No change.
Okay. There's no problem then, right?
I don't know about that, but that was previously adopted.
We have a research study from California that shows that 5% of the people who voted in an election acknowledge to a polling team that they signed somebody else's ballot.
Okay, so, Mr. Cole, it's signature verification is provided by statute. We're not suggesting any change here.
I'm asking for the scientific study, the scientific evidence that untrained temporary workers can detect signature fraud. Well, we've been through court. I mean, we understand that that's a requirement.
Anything else on Rule 12?
Perhaps. We identified numerous detailed election problems with mail ballot elections in both a January 4th, 2002 report called 2001 Election Flaws and a February 14th, 2002 report entitled Fraud, Incompetence, or Corruption. And we'd like to know how each of these problems identified in these reports are resolved by this rule. We have a problem canvassing an election that has mail ballots and walk-in ballots. That's never been done before. There are no rules here to describe how that is done. That's a massive mistake. Rules concerning recount. Oh, if I may add one more thing, the final point under Rule 12. There's a need for clarification of the conduct of the mail ballot election under Title 31. We have a huge election and open records problem in Lafayette City, resulting from the February 27th special mail ballot election. And that's been brought to the attention of the Department of State. But there's definitely a need for clarification of how those are conducted. Rules concerning recount. We asked the question, what scientific study shows that the proposed method of recount is able to deliver an accurate election that reflects voter intent? What does the method prove? It uses what we call biased stovepipes, which cannot create a statistically uniform sample. In other words, we only test the things that fit within certain stovepipes of the data. And all of the other stuff is given a pass. So we wonder what science says that this is okay, and wonder what kind of result this is intended to get. We talk about the proposed method doesn't produce a complete or fair count, and in the case of mail ballot elections, many of errors occur before the counting phase, and by limiting the recount to the counting equipment can result in the wrong winners and losers. And we don't understand what is meant by voter error. The voter's intent is what we're trying to follow, so the voter never makes a mistake. We are deeply concerned that what that means is the rules that the ballot said that you're supposed to fill in the circle, and the voter circled the circle, and therefore the voter, you know, forget it. It's his problem. And we believe that in a recount, those circled circles wind up as votes. And in this rule, that doesn't happen.
Where's the reference to voter error?
It's in 14... Uh, 14.6, which was 24. It's on page 10 of 33, line 18. 19.
Okay, thank you.
The ballot now method described in the rule is not sound. Depending on the switches and the options set in the hardware and software, the count can be repeated. In other words, you can get the same answer twice, and it's wrong both times. Hurwitz and Walmsley and others have documented alternatives that are accurate, transparent, and verifiable. On security, Rule 43, we don't get a strong understanding of the requirements and standards for data and systems security. We see a lot of good work on physical security. The reason that comes up is in this morning's news, I'm sure that you're well aware, we find our daily reason to distrust without verification the wonderful people that work for government. This news article says two people were jailed on charges of getting at least $5 million in phony tax refunds from the state, and the third is being sought. One of the suspects was a supervisor in the Department of Revenue and authorized fraudulent tax refunds for two associates. So what we're asking for is not like blue sky. We can provide this on a daily basis if you want it from all over the country. I mean, it's just, it's everywhere. I will skip through the section on the regulatory analysis, but basically we disagree that these are the optimal cost solutions. We disagree that they're the optimal alternatives. And we conclude by saying that we hope that you take our recommendations in the spirit that they're offered. We want for Colorado the highest quality election system in the United States, and we believe that an open process is a first step in this direction.
Thank you very much. Are there any other questions for Mr. Colwitz? Thank you, Mr. Colwitz. I appreciate it.
Thank you for the time, sir.
Next, I have Jan Coonan signed up. Jan, if you would come forward, identify yourself and who you represent, please, and give us your testimony.
My name is Jan Coonan. I am the Chief Deputy Clerk and Recorder for Larimer County and the Director of Elections. I have a few comments on the proposed rules, and thank you for having this hearing and allowing us to state them. My first one, of course, doesn't appear on what I just handed to you in writing. On page 2, line 10 plus, where it is talking about the requirements for audio candidates providing names, the counties would love to see that extended to the counties as well as to the state, that there be a deadline that the candidates provide that information to us. In the last election, we had to literally hound a couple of candidates in order to get them to call in and leave that for so that we could make our audio ballots. And making audio ballots is extremely time-consuming, we have discovered, on the vendor parts. And we need as much time as possible to do that. Page 7, line 19. This is a rule that I'm actually asking for clarification on. When we're talking about more than 5 voted ballots having to be kept track of in an election. I believe that there is in the counties a difference of opinion as to whether this means 5 over the course of the entire election or 5 at one time. As I remember the history of this rule, and it really pains me to say that I have history on this rule, but I do. As I remember this rule, and Ms. Louder, you do too. As I remember this rule went into effect because there were candidates and issue committees who were actually visiting voters and requesting that the mail ballot be given to this person and that they then turn it into the clerk's office. In some cases, I believe that there was suspicion that those ballots were even possibly being voted. I think that's why this rule was put into effect, was so that we could then notice if there was more than 5 ballots at a time being delivered to our office. If, in fact, we are having to keep track of each individual person and then do an accumulation throughout the election as to who has delivered 5 different ballots, the only way that I can see that this be done is that it has to be put into a database of some kind, and those ballots are going to have to be scanned immediately because the data entry on this would be impossible. I know in the last election, a mass mail ballot election that Larimer did, which was in 2001, we had 12,000 ballots delivered on the last day. So trying to get those names put together and then issue a letter on the back end, I think really creates a problem, whereas as if we are actually telling the people watching the ballot boxes to simply watch for 5 ballots coming in at a time and then record the name and addresses of the people, seems to me to be doable, while on the other side, I'm not sure that all of the counties can comply, and we may wish to have to look at the new statewide voter registration system to see if that requirement is addressed in there. Page 8, line 1 through 11. I would ask a question there. This is in regard to line 1. Any voter may surrender a mail ballot to the designated election official and vote in person on the accessible device. Is that part of the EAC ruling, that any voter may be able to do that? If it is, I would withdraw the comment on that. If it is not, then I would ask that that consideration be given as to how many people. I don't know how to estimate how many people are going to come in, and if people are only having one spot in order for the accessible machines to be available, I'm very fearful that the lines could be extremely long and the press could be very bad. We're not servicing the voters as we need to. So I'm not sure as to what that ruling, and I apologize. I had the ruling, but I forgot to read that in relation to this before I wrote the comment.
I'm not sure I follow. The question, could you restate the question?
The question is, does the EAC direction say that any voter may come in and surrender their mail ballot, or is it simply that we have to have a walk-in polling location for the disabled to come in?
Okay. Okay, thank you.
Vote? That's my question there. Line 20. Oh, that doesn't make sense. Hold on just a second. I think I have a typo there. I think it's, Page 9, line 20, when we are, talking about, this is the recounts and testing for the recounts. Our entire team has spent a considerable amount of time on this section, and we apologize, but we simply cannot figure out how to do a test and then a recount based on the changes in this rule. We're very confused about which machines are used for the test, which machines are used for the recount, and also, do you test every VRE then on the recount with these five ballots, minimum of five ballots that are picked? It's simply not clear by the rewording on this rule as to how we proceed on a recount. So I would ask for some clarification in that area. Page 13, line 7. This is where it has been stricken that the Secretary of State shall notify the county of temporary approval. We would ask that that be left in and that the counties do notify us so that we can then mark that off our list. For one thing, we know that the county has received. It seems to me that by taking that out, you are now requiring the counties to send by certified registered mail so that we know that it's been received from you when it comes. My next comment is page 20, line 3 through 6. Again, simply a clarification. When we're talking about the Secretary of State inspecting our maintenance records, will it be acceptable that those be in? I foresee in our county that that will be kept in a database. So will reports out of that database be acceptable, or will you be asking for paper copies? Will you be visiting in person? What is it? So that we know how to design the system on the front end so that when that audit is done, you have the information that you need. Page 24, line 40 through 44, modem transmissions here. I believe the changes as allowed by the certification of the specific device. I would simply ask that in relation to modeming, that we also keep in mind the network by which we are modeming in. In Larimer County, we are using a virtual private network. We are not accessible to anyone for hacking or anything like that. And I think that's a big part of the modeming, not only the certification of the machines, but which is under Rule 45, but also the type of network that you are using to come back in on the modeming. My next one then is page 29, lines 8 through 10, and page 30, lines 32 through 34. This is talking about where, if there is any seal tampering on the machines, that the counties have 2 hours to notify and write reports to the Secretary of State. I would point out that in many of the counties, and I can only use Larimer as the example, we have polling locations that are well over an hour away from our central location. By the time I can dispatch a team to get there and see exactly what's going on, while we would pull that machine out of service immediately, I couldn't get a report until I could get a team there, and I don't think 2 hours is an adequate time for the rural areas in order to make that response to you. That concludes my comments. Thank you for listening.
Any questions for Ms. Coonan? Ms. Rudy?
Jan, I just have one question for you. With regard to that two-hour time limit, would you have a recommendation as to a reasonable amount of time based on your experience?
I can only say for Larimer, I don't know for the rural communities what the farthest away. It would take driving time for us to Red Feather Lakes is an hour and 15 minutes. I would think it would take me a good half hour to get a team dispatched by the time that I could get a car assigned to them, get the necessary equipment with them, and send them that way. And then I would have to rely on them to phone in, I guess, in order for us to do some kind of a report. I would like time for actually that machine to be brought back. That would be what our procedure would be in Larimer County, that it be brought back. And the people that actually work with the machine all the time, because I can't dispatch full-time election people at that point. These are usually county volunteers that do that. So I would think, Ms. Rudy, that, boy, I guess I would like to say as soon as practicable. I don't know if that's acceptable, but it seems like it solves the problem in that case.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. The next person I have signed up is Mary Zucano.
Thank you very much. I'm Mary Zucano. I'm the Director of Research and Policy Development for the Special District Association. Our membership includes about 1,000 special districts across the state who, of course, have election responsibilities. I submitted written comments in a letter format to Ms. Rudy back on March 19th, and I understand that those have been distributed to you all, and I don't intend to go through each of those because the ones at the end of the list are sort of, you know, wordsmithing comments, citation corrections, that sort of thing. The one I would really like to focus on is the notion of applying the disabled voting machine requirements in 1-5-705 to a mail ballot election. That section of statute refers to polling places and having this kind of equipment available at polling places, and I just assert that there is not a polling place to put that in a mail ballot election. Mail ballots are cast, you know, in a person's home, they're delivered to a mailbox or delivered to the DEO's office, but I think it blurs the distinction between a polling place and an election and a mail ballot election to take a section of statute that refers specifically to polling places and make that applicable in the mail ballot context. You know, I certainly don't mean any disrespect to the disabled community, but when I was sitting in on the hearings for Senate Bill 234, the Senator Gordon's creation of permanent mail-in status, the representatives of that community who testified at those hearings were saying, this is great. Our constituents like to be able to vote at home. That's the most convenient for them. And so I believe that having these machines available is going to be a big burden on districts to get access to those machines and to have them at these drop-off locations. I think a drop-off location is different than a polling place. and I would encourage you to see it that way. Secondly, the rule, I think it's 12.5.6 that talks about manning these drop-off locations in advance of the election. I have a concern about how we're going to find the manpower to do that. Mail ballots, as you know, are mailed out anywhere from 25 to 15 days in advance of the election, and this requires that you have a staffed location for drop-offs beginning at essentially day 23, 2 days after the mailing takes place. And what the practical application, I think, is that we just won't have as many drop-off locations available if we have to staff that during business hours from day 23 up through election day. And, you know, our members are spread throughout the state. We have very large districts acreage-wise. We've got very low population districts. There's such a huge variety that some of these things may make sense in certain parts of the state or more urban areas, but we need to remember that we have a large variety of special districts that are all going to be focusing in on trying to follow these rules. For instance, in developer districts, or what we call dirt districts, that are just new areas of the state that are being settled, there's only maybe five or six electors that are qualified, and is it possible to opt out of these rules if you can verify that you have no disabled community within your eligible elector base, perhaps. And a lot of those elections are done by mail ballot because there's just the very few electors there. They don't even set up a polling place. And so I think we need to consider that there are those kinds of districts in addition to the established directors with the thousands of voters. Finally, in just talking about, I believe it would be a real hardship on districts to require that equipment. We are already facing the problem that that the new security rules on voting equipment is going to make leasing or borrowing voting machines from the counties not an option anymore. And so I just feel like the rules are becoming so dense around our elections that I'm concerned about how we're going to try to comply with the requirements to have these disabled voting machines available as well. And special districts will probably be holding more mail ballot elections as a result of House Bill 1159, which requires that all ballot issue elections in special districts will now be conducted as either part of a coordinated election or as mail ballot. So that will increase the number of mail ballot elections that we need to do. I think when a jurisdiction makes a choice to hold a mail ballot election versus a polling place election, that's a deliberate choice between do we want to staff polling places, do we want to train certain numbers of election judges, can we recruit those people to participate, getting machines and all the things. And when a jurisdiction elects to do a mail ballot election, I think they do so with the idea that some of those rules fall away and some of those extra details fall away by choosing to do mail ballot. And if needing to get handicap accessible machines now comes back into the picture, that changes that dynamic, and I think it creates a hybrid kind of election that really doesn't exist in statute. It blends and mixes mail ballot and polling place. I think I'll end my testimony with that. That's the gist of our concerns, is just the burden and the hardship on the districts and in conducting their elections. Can I answer any questions?
I would like to ask a question or two, and I'm not sure this elicits anything beyond what you've already said, but I'm trying to just think through the consequences, for example, of if an accessible machine were required in every election. Practically, how would special districts do that? Would they end up, is it simply a matter of expense, or would they end up coordinating with county clerks, or what would happen as a practical matter?
Well, I don't know in terms of a May election, for instance, if we're talking about doing an election in May, county clerks don't coordinate those for us, so we wouldn't have the option of saying, please, take over. We'll pay you. So I think that would have to be done independently, that we'd have to seek out the machine companies. And I frankly, I've never programmed, you know, a ballot or anything, but I understand that that's part of that whole process.
Okay. And I'm, the other thing I'm just trying to think through is what the pros and cons may be of providing an accessible machine. I mean, I understand that probably a lot of voters with disabilities really do like the ability to vote by mail.
Mm-hmm.
But it's my understanding that maybe some, especially with blind voters and others with mobility problems who would nevertheless need assistance at home to vote, might actually prefer to be able to vote privately and independently by going to a polling location, but that's a pretty important principle as well. And I'm just trying to think, that I don't know whether you have a comment about it, but I'm trying to balance that out.
I don't know. I am. When you were talking before about how things would practically happen, you know, the mail ballots now can be turned in either at the, you know, in a by mail, sent in by mail, or at the DEO's office or at a place designated. And in some cases, I think DEOs that run special district elections are the paralegals of the law firms that are general counsel for the districts. And so I can't imagine how those people end up getting the machines into the office. You set one up in the law firm lobby, and I don't know practically how that would work.
Okay. Thanks. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Meg Costello.
Hi. My name is Meg Costello. I'm the Associate Director at Colorado Common Cause, and I'm also going to testify on behalf of the Legal Center for People with Disabilities and Older People. So I'm taking Faith Gross's spot.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'll keep mine really short because I don't feel very good. We just have a few recommendations, and then I have a couple questions that maybe you can help clarify. Pertaining to Rule 12.5, we recommend that all counties should have a minimum number of locations geographically distributed. So that could be based on population of the county, and our recommendation would be 2 to 15 locations depending on the size of the county, because we realize that counties out in rural Colorado don't require 15 polling locations like maybe Denver would. And our other recommendation is that all walk-in locations should also be treated as polling locations, which would allow all voters to use the machines, vote provisionally, et cetera, and will help with not segregating voters with disabilities.
So contrary to the testimony we just heard?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And that would be to your point that there are voters with disabilities that do like to go to the polls, let's say blind voters, or and actually cast their vote independently and privately. And then my questions, just for Rule 12.11.1, I think that's talking about a voter can surrender their ballot if they choose to go to the polling place. And the question is, if the voter doesn't have their ballot, if let's say it never got mailed to them or they lost it, can they still vote on the machine, or do they need to vote provisionally? And if they do vote provisionally, can that be done? Is the machine certified for that? And then the other question is, will the walk-in balloting locations be polling places since they have voting machines and election judges, or is it just for people with disabilities?
Okay. I don't know, but we'll take that into consideration.
Okay.
Then. So.
And that's all I have.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Is there anybody? I don't have anybody else signed up. Is there anybody else? Mr. Balin. If you would, maybe after, you could do it after your testimony, if you would, please. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Hobbs. I don't have much to say. I just have a general comment about the new rule on registration of homeless voters. It was mentioned earlier about concerns in general about citizenship and proof of citizenship, which is one of my biggest concerns. But beyond that is the ID requirements. And all I see this as doing is making it easier and easier. Not that I don't like accessibility to the ballot, but not only can you now register to vote in Colorado by not providing any identification whatsoever, that's a fact. Now you don't even have to really have an address, and even though, yes, this rule suggests that you give one, so I'll give one. It's just like everything else. It might not be very valid as opposed to most people who have a permanent location. I just think this is further watering down of maybe allowing more people to vote than are actually eligible, but I don't want to go much further on that one. I'm only here now just to stand up and make comment, if I may, with regard to this hearing. I appreciate all these hearings. Anytime you have a public hearing to allow people to give input is a wonderful thing. I know that the Secretary of State's office always welcomes that, and I know that all clerks in every county ought to welcome that, and I think they all do. If not, shame on them. Regular input by the voters, concerned citizens, are very important. So I'm rising on behalf of Colorado's arrogant know-it-alls, and I'd like to suggest that those who make it a hobby to engage in the election process, one, we welcome it, but two, I suggest that we are no more arrogant than they are. I just always take offense to name calling, and I think there's not one county clerk or person in the election business in Colorado who is not more concerned than any other citizen in the state of Colorado with regard to conducting fair and honest elections. And just for example, even though we've had some turnover in our office the last few years, I think all for the positive, our top four people in elections, not counting myself, have a collective 75 years experience in elections. So I appreciate specifically Mr. Colwitz and his group, but anybody else who wants to be engaged in the election process, but I don't think that any of us are arrogant know-it-alls. So thank you very much.
Could I ask one question, Mr. Balink, before you slip away? Going back to the homeless voting rule, I mean, is there a suggestion of another approach we should take, or is that just simply a general concern
It's a tough one. I agree. I think Mr. Colwitz said very well that we're not against anybody voting, although mm-hmm. I will give you a direct quote from Senator Gordon last November, whatever the Thursday was before elections. Bob, access to the ballot for everyone is more important than determining someone's eligibility to vote. Close quote. Senator Gordon running for Secretary of State to myself, to my face. So that concerns me. Access to the ballot is important. But when you have Colorado law that says who is eligible to vote, starting with citizenship, and two, starting with the must provide a Colorado driver's license or other government ID, but if you don't have it, that's okay, even though you must provide it, or the last four digits of your Social Security number, and if you're not smart enough to make them up, and you don't give us any, we'll give you unique identifying numbers, which is a federal issue we ought to be addressing. But the fact of the matter is it's way too easy now for people who aren't eligible, and I was going to suggest in a private conversation with Secretary Kaufman that since the law, but he's not here today, and I was hoping to do it today, since the law requires citizenship, I don't know why we have to wait for another bill to pass the legislature like 1013, which was in the special session last summer requiring proof of citizenship and also ID at the time of voting, and Senate Bill 65 in January, which required the exact same thing, proof of citizenship and an ID for voting. I'm not sure why, since the law now requires that someone be a citizen, by the Secretary of State, perhaps through rules or perhaps through the form that it promulgates that we all use, the form that we use to register people, why it can't, in fact, require proof of citizenship. Because the question I always ask is it possible, with a self-affirmation that is now on the form, for non-citizens to vote or register to vote? And the answer is absolutely. And I cannot guarantee that I'm following the law when Colorado Statute 12202, if I remember every section of the statute, Title I, 12202 tells very clearly that county clerks and recorders must register eligible electors only, as defined in 12101, citizens 18 18 years of age on or before Election Day, et cetera. So, you know, I'm still concerned about this, and I'm not sure that the homeless thing is not going to be doing anything but causing more problems with potential non-eligible people voting.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Mr. Colwitz, you have testified.
Yes, I just.
If you'll come to the podium and 13, is that the number? Okay.
Ms. Colwitz back. I just want to apologize to anybody for that was offended by my attempt at wit when I characterized the bad guys using the phrase arrogant know-it-alls. That wasn't intended to focus on persons, and it was intended to show the distance between the way it should be and the way it might be.
Thank you very much. If there's no other testimony, then we'll conclude the hearing. I will leave the rulemaking record open until the close of business on this Friday, May 4th. So if anybody wishes to submit written comments, please do so by 5 o'clock on Friday, and you can direct them to Hillary Rudy of our office. And any additional written comments that we receive, we will take into account in the final rulemaking. So with that, I'll adjourn the meeting. For the record, the time is 3 o'clock. Thank you all.